Okay, we're here this morning with Michael Gaynor, running for the mayor of the city of Buffalo. And this week what we want to talk about is education. And I'm doing it this week because this is one of the things I've been asked about quite frequently by people that I know and people that I run into as I've started doing these podcasts. So there's a public perception that our schools here are essentially a disaster and that the whole system is hopeless. You know, and I think an example of that is the fact that we had a superintendent for years who didn't even live in the city of Buffalo and lived in Florida and was running the Buffalo Public Schools. And one of the things reasons I think it is so critical for the whole of the city, not just for the education and growth of our kids, but that it does have an oversized impact on a city's ability to function economically. It's one of the things that will help bring business here, bring talent here, you know, and there's other components of that, but that is a core component of it, a solid school system and good public amenities that make a city a desirable place to live in and raise a family in.
Right.
So I want to start at a, you know, like backtrack a bit and have you explain how the school system here functions. So who runs it? Mm-hmm. How is it paid for? And then the other thing that we've heard, and I'd like to sort of delve into this, and then we can go into sort of the changes that you might make or want to make or more details. But is it or is it not true that, as we've heard, that the mayor can't actually do anything about education in the city of Buffalo?
Yeah, that sounds great. So, you know, my understanding is that we have a superintendent that largely controls the culture and the, you know, the, you know, largely the culture and the priorities for the district. They are the ones that set priorities. They're the ones that hold individual schools accountable for outcomes and learnings. They're the ones that kind of chart a course for how we're going to improve if we believe that our educational system isn't working well. That superintendent serves at the pleasure of the board, the school board, which, you know, hires the superintendent. There are elected officials throughout all of our communities that hopefully prioritize the education and educational needs of young people and families in the district, and they put forth those values and priorities, and those are the folks that come together and respond to the needs of the community, respond to the concerns, respond to issues that bring to light different issues, and then hopefully the chain of command brings those issues to the superintendent. The superintendent is often in attendance at those meetings. They're public meetings. I've attended a lot of them because we've been involved in schooling activities here in Western New York. And, you know, the system, that's my understanding of how the system works.
So just one, some clarifications about the school board. So is the school board, how long are the terms for the school board, and is it entirely elected, or are there different people, like somebody from the city and somebody from the, like different people on the board as well that aren't necessarily elected?
I think they're all elected members, but don't quote me on that. I'm not completely positively sure, but I know that in the meetings that we've recently had, there are at-large members, and then there's district members, and then there's the superintendent. And then there are some of the superintendent staff at those board meetings that often are taking notes and, you know, and documenting a lot of the comments and the responses from the crowd and from the audience and from the members and from parents, so that they can then follow up on those things. And that's been my experience with the board. The board, the superintendent has a large staff at that their offices at City Hall. That's where I often would run into Tanja Williams, is that when she'd be going in or out of City Hall. So I know that that's where they're based. And yeah, I guess that's the mandate. The majority of the funding actually comes from the state of New York. So in cities like Buffalo, where there is a higher percentage of low-income youth, a city like Buffalo gets much more state-supported funding. So the city does contribute to the board, but it's dwarfed in comparison to the contribution of the state. I think the city contribution is just over $100 million that comes directly from the tax collections of the city of Buffalo.
So does the state then, because they're putting so much money in, does the state actually have some control over the system or none?
I'm not really sure how much influence the state has in terms of that. They obviously, the State Board of Education does look specifically at failing schools, and when there is an issue of lower student achievement in the charter school realm, in a public school realm, they have, I know that they do have influence in the process. How that plays out on a day-to-day basis, I'm not really privy to. But you know, I think that there's a larger conversation, which I think we'll probably get into, just about how, you know, we can impact. I think that the reason why a lot of mayors don't get involved is because there are some cities that have mayoral control of the school board, which means those school board members aren't elected by the general public. They're appointed by the mayor. And that gives the mayor's office unprecedented influence and power over the decision-making authority of the district and also who becomes the superintendent. And I've gone back and forth just in terms of whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I really think at the end of the day, it comes down to leadership and who that mayor is, what their experience in education is, what their priorities and values are as it pertains to education. Because I think that when you have one person in control of that, that's a lot of power and influence and not a lot of accountability. And that kind of freaks me out. I think that having, you know, public elections for school board members offers more checks and balances, gives the public an opportunity to be more involved in the education of their communities. But it doesn't necessarily directly correlate into student learning and outcomes. So I think that's where, you know, as a mayor, I'm thinking, okay, this is the system that probably serves the school district better, but yet we still have decreasing outcomes in both reading and math literacy. I mean, there was just an article in The Atlantic that we'll get into in a minute. But the point is that there are many things outside of the actual leadership structure and the board structure of this, the city of Buffalo, that I think we can influence, not just in my role as the next mayor, but also as our role as community members and our role as we, you know, support other efforts, community efforts, not-for-profit efforts, you know, just being a good parent or grandparent or nephew or, I mean, or aunt or uncle or neighbor to really support the educational outcomes in our city. But I think it's an important mandate, right? Because, you know, my goal is to increase the city's population, you know, because that leads to more vibrant, healthier communities. And to do so, we need to have an educational system and an educational community that really supports the needs of parents as they enter childbearing, you know, phase of their life and want to, you know, start families. We want to give them the support they need to stay here, because I think a lot of young people, they go to have families and raise families, and they go to areas that have better schools. So mm-hmm. often in suburban areas. So that's a loss for our city.
So I want to do a couple more like short questions, and then we can start getting into your larger ideas. So, like, really, is it the case that the mayor has no control, or is that in somewhat like some truth to that, and some also like I just want to absolve my hands of this mess?
I think it's both. I think that there's not actually direct authority of the mayor between the mayor and the school board of education. But I think that there is an opportunity for relationship building there. So even though there's not a formal structure or formal system of accountability where the superintendent is reporting in any way to the mayor or the school board for that matter, I think that there's a lot to be done in terms of influencing direction and input and priorities and values by just creating a relationship there. And I think that previous mayors, and our most recent mayor in particular, not Scanlon, but Brown, I think that he had very little interest at all in education. I don't even know if he even said it the word publicly, other than his summer reading challenge, which, you know, gets into where a mayor can be influential, right? By championing these ideas, these initiatives, these community education priorities, these, you know, if as the mayor, you can walk into a school any day of the week if you wanted to, you know, talk to the principal and say, hey, can I come and talk to the kids? You know, and go classroom to classroom, and the impact that that would have on a young person's life to, you know, be able to interact and engage with and have a conversation with their city's mayor, I think is just a really wonderful opportunity. But I don't think that we actually pursue that, because I think that even culturally, this is beyond the office of the mayor. I think that almost even culturally, so many of us, with the advent of compulsory education, basically wiped our hands and cleaned our hands of being in the role of educators for our young people. And I think that that's a real loss culturally and educationally. And we see that play out in just how it's affected learning outcomes for our young people.
Mm-hmm. And just also some another kind of background point. So New York City now has mayoral control of this. And I don't know if there's no longer a school board in New York City, so these are things I'm wondering. But I know that there's a commissioner, mm-hmm. and this was done under the Bloomberg administration, mm-hmm. and it had to be, you know, the state was involved in doing this, so he had to go to the state and say, this is what we want right. to do. So, you know, can you fill in anything about the system in New York?
I can't, actually. I don't know a lot about the system in New York. I do know that it's controversial in terms of what people, the people that do support mayoral control. I know there are people in our own community here that are strong advocates because, you know, and I understand it because you look at what we're spending on education per pupil here, which is just north of $30,000 per kid per year. We were looking at last night just the cost of some of the very elite private schools here in Western New York, per pupil, almost a third less. And these are some of the highest performing private schools in the state. Buffalo SEM was one of them. And I think the tuition there was like 22 or 24,000 per pupil. So that's, you know, there's that should give people pause that, you know, you have elite private schools and even university educations that, you know, at university tuition that is less than what we're spending per pupil. So, you know, you try 100 different things if you're a parent or someone that's committed to education here in the area, and those things aren't working, and it's been a democratic, you know, publicly elected school board system. So they're like, well, maybe we just scrap this and try something different. Like, I understand that desire to just push on every door until something gives, you know, and to try different things in the interest of improving educational outcomes, because what we're doing and what we have been doing clearly isn't working, because we still have unprecedented numbers of people that leave school. We still have high truancy rates. We still have high absentee rates for even young children. We have a lot of different needs that really aren't being addressed. And we just continue year after year to do the same thing. And I think the reason why we just continue to graduate kids and there's still people that are passing out of the system is because we've lowered our expectations. We've consistently lowered our expectations so that we can continue to do, you know, keep the system running with very little accountability. And, I've been grateful in my life to be part of a lot of different educational organisms that are doing things really differently, responding to the failures of public education. I mean, it's why when I first came to Buffalo, my intention was to start a training program specifically for kids that had dropped out or been thrown out of the public school system, because it was such a dramatic need. At the time, the completion rate, the high school completion rate when I first got here in 2005 was just over 55% in the city of Buffalo, which means we were losing almost half of our kids over a 4-year term. Now, they're saying that the completion rate now is north of 80%, and I don't see what we've done differently in the last 20 years. So either we're helping people complete education by lowering our standards, or we're playing with the numbers by using people that are enrolled in a Buffalo Public Schools GED program as being in school. Or, you know, I'm not sure what else. But I haven't seen anything nationally that significantly has changed how we talk about and engage our neighbors with this conversation in education in the last 25, 30 years, pretty much since I was in college. So
I'm interested to know what your priorities would be.
Yeah. Well, my priorities are multiple, many, you know, very holistic and tie in with many of the other initiatives that we've highlighted for our administration. And you know, it starts with where I see the most profound need, which still is at the neighborhood level. When we talk about community safety and we talk about, you know, young people that are on the streets causing trouble, and we talk about a public school system that still fails many of our learners because it doesn't really embrace the unique learning styles of all of our children. Like, where it's a school system that's very much focused on academic learning, but doesn't offer tangible opportunities for technical training or more experience-based learning or, you know, professional skill-based learning, where we're really acknowledging that there's all kinds of different learners. You know, when I first came into into public school, there was almost an immediate into the, you know, I think it was middle school, seventh, eighth, you know, you start meeting with a counselor and they start to look at your records and how your grades are and ask you questions about what you like to do and this and that. And then there was a process called tracking, where if you seemed like you were an academic track kid, you'd go into the academic, you know, coursework. But if you seemed like you were a more hands-on person, a more kinesthetic person, maybe a person that had a hard time sitting in your seat all day long, but was really talented at ripping things apart and putting things back together, or was excelling in shop class, they'd steer you towards technical training programs. And they were very robust, you know? And people would graduate and go on to jobs and electricians or plumbers or mechanics and live a good life, you know? That's really what it's about, just living a good life, happiness, and having an educational system that supports that. Now I've seen that we've wandered so dramatically from that, you know, where I remember when Obama was, you know, elected president and he did his speech in Chicago and how he proclaimed that his goal was for every kid to go to college. And I was like, you don't have a strong grasp on how people learn if that's your goal, because there and you don't really have a strong grasp on what the economic needs of our communities are if that's your priority. Because now we're in a community and a culture where you have a hard time getting a trained technician to show up at your house to give you a quote for your roof or to fix your bathroom or to run new electrical. So we're in this situation now where there are jobs that we can't create with AI, where we need real people doing the job, where we need skilled people, and we've fallen behind. And not only that, we've fallen behind academically because, you know, all of the different things, all of the different distractions in our lives. And I think from an educational philosophy standpoint, we've wandered so dramatically from some of the core childhood development principles that have been researched and studied just by observing small humans and how small children learn, the importance and necessity of play. And as it relates to socialization, as it relates to, you know, conflict resolution, as it relates to self-identity and what your role is in a community of people and how you deal with conflicts and how you problem solve and how, like, that is so fundamental, not just to who are we as humans, but to normal child development, that we have an opportunity and an opening. And what have we seen in education? Where we've slashed recess, where kids have less exposure to nature, where they have less autonomy and choice over how they spend their days and how they interact with other people, where we see people constantly intervening when there's a conflict instead of just letting kids work it out. Like, sometimes conflict is really good, you know, particularly for a young person as they're learning and navigating, you know, the world. So, you know, that's one component, is play and how normal that is in terms of and important that is in terms of normal child development. And then all of the other things, you know, we call it now accelerated learning, where we're trying to get young people to learn earlier and earlier, faster and faster. But we're learning that it's not working. Like, just because they're learning earlier doesn't make them better in terms of reading outcomes and in terms of math outcomes. None of these have gotten better as we've moved up the time frame for all of this skill development. You know, I studied education for years, and Paulo Freire, a very early education theorist, learned that young people learn naturally to read somewhere between the age of 3 and the age of 11. Well, in America, if you're not reading by the time you're 6 or 7, you're learning disabled, which means you go into remedial courses. And what is the impact of that on a young person's psychology and self-concept and feelings of self-worth? I know my daughter had no interest in picking up a book on her own until she was 7 years old. But her language development was extraordinary. We read together for hours and hours and hours. Her understanding and comprehension was through the roof. But she just didn't have an interest. And then when she did, she took off. So we've wandered culturally, socially, as a community, away from these fundamental priorities that are really the foundation of learning and health and happiness and contentment, and in favor of information, right? Jamming their heads with as much as possible. Well, guess what? You pick up a phone today and you can get any information you want anywhere. But that doesn't mean because you have that information that you have a healthy relationship with your partner or with your kids or with the kid down the block or with your neighbor. So there's a lot more involved in education. And I think that that's something that gets lost in the conversation, is that we focus on testing and testing outcomes and reading scores and math scores, but we don't focus on, is this a good person? And I think that that's my role as someone that's leading a city, is I call it, you know, in my platform, it's called the culture of care. Like, how do we build support systems in our community where people feel cared for? You know, how do we build educational systems and investments where people feel like they have a sense of community and support, like we see at Delvin Grider or Emerson Park.
So are these specific schools?
No, they're not schools. This is learning that's happening outside of school. And I think that that's the point, is that.
So these happening in, just so that everybody understands, are you talking about community centers that are doing training?
Yeah. So specific initiatives would be, number one, our program called City Action Corps. Right, which is designed to provide a mentoring and training opportunity for young people that are out of school. They're underemployed, they're undereducated, they're on the streets, but they want an opportunity. I have met scores of these young people. When I first came to Buffalo in 2005, I recruited scores of them for Buffalo Youth Corps. They're young people that we're going to train and mentor and surround with caring people that aren't going to let them give up. And they're going to do meaningful work in our communities, planting trees, transforming vacant lots, helping the elderly, and they're going to get the educational support that they need. So at the end of this year-long program, they graduate and go to Northland and get a technical skill, or they go to Erie County Community College and get an associate's degree, or they apply to go to college at Harvard. I mean, many of these kids have immense capacity and potential, but the structure of our educational system failed them. So that's one aspect, is looking at the failures of our educational system and trying to provide a support, and hopefully one that connects the dots, that also helps us to get work done at the neighborhood level that improves the quality of life in our neighborhoods. That's one initiative. The second initiative is to put our money, our resources, our time, and build communities around current resources, or build capacity where there isn't some. We have an amazing community center right now, the Dorothy Collier Community Center on East Utica. It's a great building, and there's very little use at all. Very little programming, very little. But it's a building that the city pays for, pays the heat for. It's got a commercial kitchen. It's got a gymnasium. It's got a computer lab. It's got a ballet studio in the basement. But there's very few people that walk through the doors of that building. And it's right in the center of an urban neighborhood that would really benefit from education and programming. That's low-hanging fruit. You know, a small investment there, one staff person, and then I don't know even how robust now in the Trump administration AmeriCorps is now, but you get young people from the universities that are wanting to engage with kids through the teacher education program at Canisius. You get a bunch of those kids to come after school and you run an after school program, you know, or you run a early childhood program where parents can come with their 3 and 4 year olds so that they're part of a community where you just do something consistently, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It doesn't cost hardly anything. And we're already paying for the building. And I contrast that reality where a program or a building or a resource gets hardly any support or funding to that of Delavan Grider, where, you know, they benefited from Byron Brown's administration. And that program, any day of the week you go into Delavan Grider, there's 5 or 6 different things happening for families and kids. Family education programs, support groups, youth sports, all kinds of things. But that's the type of thing where if we make those investments in every neighborhood, it becomes transformative in terms of helping young kids and families be prepared for education. Everybody yells and screams about parents, about the deterioration of culture and parents don't do their jobs anymore. Well, yeah, but we also don't take care of each other anymore. You know, people don't feel connected. They feel like they're on an island. They feel alone. And until we prioritize opportunities to bring people together and create community and create connection, then we're going to continue to yell and scream about that. You know,
you bring up specific success stories, and you know, I'd like to touch on that too, because I think, first off, I agree with a lot of your kind of history of like your feelings about education and sort of the important things, you know, and I get that from, you know, my wife and I talk about this a lot, and it's how we want to raise our daughter and the type of schooling we want her in. And that goes back to our personal experience. You know,
right.
I went to all different, I traveled a lot as a kid. I went to all different types of schools.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there were certain environments where I simply could not learn.
Right.
But Buffalo, you know, we see it as this monolithic school system.
Mm-hmm.
But really, you know, I mean, personally, we know some Buffalo public school teachers, and these are like incredibly dedicated.
Yeah.
Like they are teachers through and through, and they take their jobs really seriously, and they're good teachers. And then you have schools like, let's say, the Olmsted and then the City Honors Program, which, you know, is absolutely the right environment for kids. But it is a school that's held up as a very high standard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like this is one of the best schools, not just in the city of Buffalo, but in the county. And so what you see happen is parents want to get their kids in Olmsted so that they can then go to City Honors. And that's like their focus. Like the kid is 5 years old. They're like, we got to get into Olmsted.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's clearly parts of the school system that are functioning well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my question is, how do you translate that across the rest of the system? And how do you, because I think some of it is also this, like I brought up the perception of the entire school system, right?
Right.
So it's not the whole school system that's in the dumps, but it's sort of like, I don't know, I'm thinking out loud here. It's sort of like, you know, the condition of the East Side is in large part simply an abandonment, a decades-long abandonment of that part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just, we're not going to, like, this part of the city doesn't matter anymore, so we're going to ignore it. And is that what's happened to the school system as well?
Yeah, and it feels like that's the case. Like, we do focus and put a lot of energy into these school systems that have traditionally done a long time. I mean, have done very well over time. And I don't know if, you know, that same standard or expectation or culture exists in our other school communities. So, like, for me, that's the question to ask, and those are the answers that I don't know. But if I was an administrator, I would be looking at the disparities that exist between, you know, the schools that are performing well and the schools that aren't. And it does seem like there's two tiers. There is the schools that we just spoke about, the ones that you test into, and you immediately, because you've achieved the bar in terms of what their admission testing is, you now have higher expectations, and you're now in this more vibrant culture, and you have more opportunities, and this and that. And the rest of the kids, I don't know. What are we offering them? And I think that, you know, as an administrator, if those would be the things that I would be looking at. But I would also want to glean some wisdom from these experiences and see how, in the more successful schools, how that's transferable to these other programs. Because I don't necessarily think that there's not something to learn from that. Like, I think that we need to have high expectations for the learning of all kids. And just acknowledging that maybe some kids are learn at a different rate. I also, you know, fundamentally, philosophically, I do have a little bit of a problem with this tiered program, because I think that every school should be able to have that level of quality. You know, I have a lot of experience and exposure to Toronto public schools, and there's not a system where you test into a school. You know, I mean, there may be one or two. It's a very big school district up there. And I don't know, maybe I'm misquoting. But I do know that there is a very concerted focus on good quality schools in every neighborhood, in every community. And there are wealthy neighborhoods in Toronto, and they get the same funding, and there's the same opportunity, and there are low-income neighborhoods in Toronto. And they get more funding and more opportunity because they understand that the needs of those young people are greater. So they've acknowledged that there's this disparity in our communities, and they're compensating for it in their approach, their pedagogy, their resources, and what they divert to these other programs to make sure that every kid has the same access and opportunity to get a quality education. So, you know, I haven't dug into the school board here. I've been mostly immersed with all of the balls that just fall out, you know, of the system that, you know, in dealing with the adverse outcomes of a system that isn't working, and trying to think about, all right, how do we deal with those aspects of the program? But I'm very excited to have the time to actually think about the educational system. I've actually reached out to the new superintendent, and I've obviously had a much greater interest in understanding, you know, both the strengths and the weaknesses of our system, because I do want to be involved. And I think that, you know, it needs to be a team-centered approach in everything that we do. You know, I want people to come to Buffalo, and I want them to stay in Buffalo, and I want people to move their businesses here because it's an educated and it's a skilled workforce. And I want that to be one of the assets in the checkboxes that employers are considering when they think about moving a business to downtown Buffalo. Like, they know that young people want to be close to their jobs. They know they want healthy, vibrant, safe communities in proximity to where they work. So, like, as a leader of the city, like, you can't just pluck these individual aspects out and try to solve them and make them better. You have to think about how the whole system is structured and organized to support our long-term goals. And that's a big anchor on the city. You know, I had a friend who has been kind of following me around to a few house parties, and I don't talk a lot about education. I really haven't in this campaign at all. But you're going to hear me in the next week talk a lot about it, because it's, you know, like, this is like the kickoff to the education week, this podcast. But I feel like it's so integral. But anyway, we were at a house party over on Grant Street, just standing on the street. And he was like, and we had some very intense conversations about education. He was like, you really should talk more about education. Because I think that even though it's not my directive and it's not, you know, something that I have immediate responsibility for, it is this big umbrella that really is a shelter and a protection for the whole city. And I think that, you know, we have to think about how to do it better, you know.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, even as I listened to you talk, and I know you said in the beginning you didn't, like, you weren't convinced about this idea of mayoral control, and there's pluses and certainly some minuses to it, but it seems like in this conversation that there has to be some form of, and so how do we get that? Is it is it by going to a full system of mayoral control? Is it by, like, that there should be, you know, somebody from
some board members that are appointed to the board? Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, we're all working together here, and I think that it's a little bit absurd to me that the overall leadership of the city has no formal say in how we educate children. We're talking about 30,000 young people, a $1.19 billion budget. That's twice the city's entire budget that we spend on education here in the city. And to say that the mayor and our elected officials have no say in that whatsoever is a little absurd. Now, playing devil's advocate, I don't know if there's not someone that's thinking about the big picture, somebody that has an educational background in that role, maybe I don't want them to have influence. That's the flip side of mayoral control, is if you're going to hand out private vouchers to families. Now, some people might think private vouchers are great, but that's all good and well. There's positives and negatives to that too. But at the end of the day, it creates a system of winners and losers. Mm-hmm. All right. It's just like privatization of the postal service, right? Mm-hmm. In the communities where there's a lot of people, guess what? You get good service. But out in the country, you're neglected. So we got to move to a more, you know, equitable situation and system that gives all kids equal access to education, and not just equal. Some, we have to recognize that there are greater needs in some communities. So maybe we have to provide more resources and more support and more enrichment and more before and after in some communities than we need to do in others. You know, in some communities, their parents have disposable income to put them into ballet and sports and learning an instrument. And in other families, that's not even attainable. So maybe, you know, we have to everything, in my opinion, this, I look through everything through a lens of parity, because I acknowledge that it's an unequal world and that some communities have greater needs. And I do spend, I mean, it's the reason I've lived and worked on the East Side for 20 years, because it needs it. And I feel like I have something to contribute there. And we have to approach every challenge from that same perspective, which is, guess what? There are some greater needs in some communities. So if we want everybody to have the same access to education and opportunity in a college education if they choose, or to a technical training program if they choose, or just the opportunity to finish school, like, what do we have to do? What are the needs of that community that get us there? Because I know that if that's our perspective, if that's the approach that we have, that we'll figure out a plan to make sure that happens. But what I see is kids that just test out, they go to another school, they get taken care of, and then it even reduces the level of expectation that we see in the kids that are left over. Because the assumption is that, they're underperformers, they're not smart, they're not. And then this becomes self-perpetuating. It becomes, what's the word? Not self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, so if we have high expectations and we couple that and pair that with support services in the neighborhoods that need it most, I know that it will pay dividends.
The last thing I want to touch on for this conversation, and it's a real challenge, and I certainly don't have the answer to it, but busing in neighborhood schools. Mm-hmm. And so I understand the history of busing at least mm-hmm. reasonably well. I'm certainly not an expert, but, you know, in terms of one of the things you're discussing is is, you know, the community around the school and the mm-hmm. community that exists around the education. And, you know, we know parents that have kids that go to Buffalo Public Schools and they're spending, you know, an hour one way on the bus mm-hmm. to get to their school. Mm-hmm. And so I just think about that in terms of time out of a kid's day,
of course.
In terms and the erosion of all the other things that used to happen in school, after school activities, and so that's being put onto a bus. And then the other thing that you lose from that is neighborhood friends, right? And mm-hmm. and sort of a community, and we want to blame social media and all this stuff, which certainly, you know, has lots of blame to accept. But I wonder about that notion, and I know that's been something that's
I think that busing is a direct response of initially with segregated schools was a tool for desegregation, and now it's a tool for trying to have more equity in schools. Instead of making every school a better school, right, you know, we're moving people all around. And then we have this added expense. I can't remember if it was $500 million contract for the next 10 years for just busing. I'm pretty sure that was the number that I saw, or maybe it was 5 years. But it's an extraordinary amount of money to just move people around the city when the healthiest, most sustainable approach is to have a community-based school model. But you can't have a community-based school model until you have equitable investment and support for all of our schools. And it's really, you can't put the cart ahead of the horse. You can set that as a priority, but then you need to have a roadmap for how to get there. How do we make sure that if we have a neighborhood school that there's parity, mm-hmm. that school is supported in the same way that a school in North Buffalo is supported, or a school in South Buffalo? You know, so I think that's a Herculean effort to turn the page on that. But again, it comes down to leadership and intention, you know, and how we're going to dedicate and allocate our resources. And I also think it has to happen in the context of, you know, a bigger vision for how we improve the quality of life in neighborhoods. You know, there was a conversation that emerged during the Capital School Investment Program about addressing the needs of neighborhoods and the immediate access to the school. So all the adjacent streets around, and that vision never came to fulfillment. Like, we never saw that plan really happen. I mean, it's hard work. This is the hard work of governing. This is what differentiates me as a community builder from another elected official. Okay, that doesn't have the same priority and value, right? Is that this isn't about just distributing money and balancing a budget. This is about how to have communities be really supportive of families, and to have, you know, communities that support our residents. Like, they don't right now. Like, we don't need to debate it. Our communities are not supportive of families. Our communities are not safe, all right? There are big issues. Yes, the numbers are one thing, but there are big issues that you don't just address by throwing more money at it. That has been debunked. We are not going to improve education by spending more per pupil. That's horseshit. Like, we need to think about it in the context of community. And until we have leaders that we elect and we prioritize that give priority to families and communities and small business, we're going to be stuck in the same violent, all right, pattern of throwing money at problems without addressing the real root causes, you know? Yeah. And that's that's the thing. And you add the phones to the whole equation, you know, and how the impact of social media. I have to just share this because I was going to, and it's like, is that, you know, the unintended consequence, and I love that the governor got on the bandwagon of cell phone free schools, and I know there's backlash in the communities, but let me tell you, the kids have the phones all day long. Hundreds of years went by where if we had a trouble, we could call the superintendent or the principal of the school and we could get in contact with our kid, and that's still the case. The unintended consequence of cell phone free schools is an exponential increase in kids signing books out of libraries. You know, that was the unintended consequence. It was a school in Kentucky that reported that. They had to bring in another librarian. What does that mean? That means kids are reading more. That means kids are talking more, right? That means kids are playing more. Like, these are the cultural values that we need to embrace as community people, as parents, not as educators or leaders. Forget that. Just as community members and parents, how we take care of each other, how we you know, hold little kids accountable. I was over on Dana Road the other day with a friend, actually the family that I first moved into here in Buffalo. Three kids walk by, bike by. One's wearing a helmet, two aren't. And Lynn yells to them, "Where's your helmet?" Like, that is how we as a community care for each other, you know? And if we're all looking after it, if we're all taking accountability and are all responsive to the family next door that has a domestic dispute, and maybe we don't feel courageous enough to confront that ourselves, but maybe we put a flyer and, you know, where a woman can get support for domestic violence in the mailbox. Or maybe we wait until she's alone and we talk to her and let her know, "I'm here to support you. Is there anything that you need for help?" Or we see that the 80-year-old neighbor is snowed in and housebound, and we at least clear their front steps so they can get out and get their mail, or, you know, get a little breath of fresh air. These little things that we don't think about because we're so focused on the busyness and craziness of our own lives. Like, that is how we start to reweave the web of support and rebuild the foundations of education. Because we care for each other. We support each other. We take care of one another. We educate our young people. We read to the kids. We show up to volunteer at a not-for-profit. You know, we participate in a block club. I mean, I was so touched this weekend. I went to Rosalind's Daycare over on Rogers Street. This is a woman that is providing daycare assistance for the last 25 years over on the east side. Has a big campus over there for kids, safe place for them to play. Every year, she shuts down the whole street. She shuts down the whole street. She gets bounce houses and they build games, and she hired somebody to come and do balloons. She had three people that she hired that were given the community haircuts. Like, I'm not saying that everybody has the capacity to do that, but like, her example was so touching to me that she is giving back in that way. Like, that culture of care, like doing what she can do, right, to show that she cares about her community. Like, it was just beautiful. And I think that that's our example. And that's got to be where we start. Break the phone, right, and get out and talk to your neighbor.
Well, the good news is you already have the slogan. So,
it's already on all my publications, all my literature. It's on my website. I believe it to the core. Yeah.
All right. Well, Mike, thanks again for the conversation. And until next time, we will see you.
Thank you.